Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 4th of March, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. Delighted to be joined by Alex Thompson from the Netherlands and also Mark Anderson from the United States. Well, I'll just say that the weather here in Plymouth, England, is appalling today. Torrential rain. It's also very cold, so I'm dressed appropriately. Well, we're going to start off with Rishi Sunak, who spoke to the nation a couple of days ago. But a lot of people received this email from the Conservatives alerting them to the fact that Rishi had been speaking on the steps of Downing Street about their country and giving a link so that you could see the full message. But before we get into at least some of the things that he said, I just wanted to say this to our audience, because many people are contacting the column and they simply ask, what on earth is going on? I don't understand it. I'm confused. Well, this is a little rule that's helped us over a number of years. So if we pop this up on screen, essentially come in from the angle that we're being attacked by our own government. But if you're not comfortable with that, let's start with this one. If you can't understand what political words or statements mean, try considering them in light of the concept that the words mean the opposite of what they appear to mean. This is a good starting point, but the reality is that if you can't understand the political words or statement, so you should understand that we are being attacked by our own government, and it's clear that society in UK is being ripped apart at an accelerating pace. Here's a little bit of a clip of the not-so-big man speaking.
I stand here as our country's first non-white prime minister, leading the most diverse government in our country's history, to tell people of all races, all faiths, and all backgrounds, it is not the colour of your skin, the God you believe in, or where you were born that will determine your success, but just your own hard work and endeavour. I love this country. My family and I owe it so much. The time has now come for us all to stand together to combat the forces of division and beat this poison. We must face down the extremists who would tear us apart. There must be leadership, not pandering or appeasement. When they tell their lies, we will tell the truth.
Well, there you are. There's only one person who would make me feel more ill than when I watch Rishi Sunak, and of course that's Tony Blair. Very quickly, for a tiny bit of comment from you, Alex, he says very casually in there that it's not God that's going to help you achieve anything. It's simply what you do. So as far as I can see, we've got a true humanist here, but he then adds, and it'll be our leadership that keeps everything on track. What do you detect by his statement there on God?
I detect, Brian, a new twist on an old tale. The Dutch idiom would say it's an old message in a new jacket, and Rishi's jacket is the usual snazzy production. He comes from a very elitist form of Hinduism himself. He wouldn't like people to dwell on that, but core tenets of his ancestors are that he is superior to other Indians, let alone other nationalities. He perhaps wouldn't like that being discussed much. But no, he's ditched all that with his financial climb to power in favor of the perfectibility of man, is the old term from it, from the French Enlightenment, which has now become universal in the West. The idea that we cannot leave our populations alone, and they can believe in their piddling gods if they want to, but really we have to interfere with and optimize them.
Yeah, so it's the we, which is the critical word, him and his ilk. Well, if we move on through the speech, of course, if you go to gov.uk, you can see the banner here, PM address on extremism, 1st of March, 2024. But what was interesting, there's also a note. Please note, political content has been redacted from this transcript. And why I'm so interested in this, of course, is political content can drastically change the meaning of the transcript. But so we're going to deal with it redacted. But I'm giving the public a warning, what was taken out and what impact did that really mean on understanding of the speech. This is some of the words. I'll try and do this as quickly as possible. He said, in recent weeks and months, we've seen a shocking increase in extremist disruption and criminality. What started as protests on our streets has descended into intimidation, threats, and planned acts of violence. Jewish children fear to wear their school uniform lest it reveal their identity. He goes on to say the Muslim women abused in the streets for the actions of a terrorist group they have no connection with. Now our democracy is itself a target. These are words, of course. There's no evidence for anything he's saying. He goes on to talk about council meetings and local events have been stormed. MPs do not feel safe in their homes. Long-standing parliamentary conventions have been upended because of safety concerns. My question is, Rishi, where is the evidence for all of these claims? We then get in the dialogue, which you find on the gov.uk site, a note that political content has been redacted. So this comes up once again, and I'm just going to keep pushing. No evidence for all of the emotive claims that Rishi Sunak is making. These statements are designed to give the impression that the country is almost under attack in it, to enable him to get the control in from the leadership that he mentioned in the video clip. So he said, I need to speak to you all this evening because this situation has gone on long enough and demands a response, not just from government, but from all of us. Who is he talking about when he's talking about us? He says, Britain's patriotic, liberal. It's got a democratic society with a proud past, and our story is one of progress. He goes on then to home in on October the 7th, if we just move on from that one. Since October the 7th, there have been those trying to take advantage of the very human angst that we all feel about the terrible suffering that war brings to the innocent. So the war, it's all sort of some terrible accident. And well, it's caused us a bit of angst, but we shouldn't really worry about the slaughter of men, women and children. It's all, well, it's all an accident. He goes on to say that you can criticise the actions of this government or indeed any government. That's a fundamental democratic right. But no, you cannot use that as an excuse to call for the eradication of a state or any kind of hatred or anti-Semitism. So I was fascinated that he doesn't name the state. Why doesn't he name it? Well, of course, the state is Israel, and this is a highly pro-Israeli a State of Israel speech, but he is manipulating his audience in every which way he can. So we'd like the audience of UK Column to understand that this speech is not about a neutral position, equal-handedness, because of course the government has set up the memorandum of understanding with Israel, and this is working in the background. So the Israeli state holds a special and favoured place in Rishi's UK politics. But he goes on and he's talking about, I asked the question when he says those trying to take advantage since October the 7th, does Rishi Sunak mean UK citizens, both Palestinian and other, who have been protesting about the slaughter? Who are the people he says are trying to take advantage of the situation? I think that's anybody who's protesting against the war and the death. But he goes on to say that on too many occasions, our streets have been hijacked by small groups. So this is all mystery. Who are these groups? Who are these hostile people who have no respect for our democratic traditions? And I rather think that's his traditions. Islam comes in, but he's only talking about extremists and people feeding off each other with right-wing groups. And then he's saying that both of these groups want a war against the values in UK. And we've got the weaponizing the evils of anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim hatred for their own ends. And he goes on to say that you can be a practicing Hindu and a proud Briton, as he is, or a devout Muslim, or a committed Jewish person and the heart of your community. And all this is underpinned by the tolerance of our established church. But what's interesting is if we go to our established church, and a big thanks to Artwell from Oxford who pointed this out to me, Archbishop of Canterbury Welby has had to apologise for refusing to meet the Palestinian Christian leader who actually did the Christmas ceremony in Bethlehem with Jesus amongst the devastation which represented Gaza. But in the background, the Church of England is also busy working on major change. And here is another initiative. This is essentially about bringing in communities worldwide into a special church network. If we go just to the next insert there. Right, so this is about the GMH and the UK ME Communications Network. This is standing for Global Majority Heritage. And what we see here is this is not Christianity in the traditional sense, but we've got a highly politicized network coming in. And if that's not bad enough, last slide here. Let's just show you that we've now got the church looking maybe to find £1 billion to repair damage that it's caused by getting involved in slavery many years ago. And the BBC text here tells us that this is relating to Queen Anne's bounty in the 18th century, where money was changing hand over slaves. But there's recently been a commissioner's report which says that although the church has said it will put £100 million to repairing the damage of slavery, that amount should be increased to £1 billion. I've already overstepped my time there, Alex, but I'm just going to say to you, quite incredible, no money in the church for things which are really important, but maybe £1 billion for redressing slavery.
And that's not the worst of it, because I'll put in the show notes another indication directly from a Church of England website that several of the Midlands dioceses, led by Birmingham but stretching across to Gloucester, have decided to put out adverts on how well they are training children, white children, that whiteness is a problem and that they are a problem. That long acronym you just showed about the clergy simply is a no-white clerical group. It's in clean contradiction to Galatians 6, isn't it, that there's no Jew nor Greek in Christ. They're racializing everything in the church.
Indeed. Well, there we are. That's one combination, Rishi Sunak with the Church of England. But think about it, the government and the Church of England is attacking this country. Mark, let's bring you in, because one of the key things that we are concerned about is the use of AI in helping frame propaganda. So welcome. What have you got?
Well, this is a snappy news item. It's a good conversation piece, that's for sure. And there's just a couple. Basically, you kind of expect the Rishi Sunaks of the world and others to have this built-in bias that we've been talking about and that Alex so ably described. But it seems that Google's own biases are getting hardwound or hardwired into AI. This is an American Free Press recent piece. Scandal exposes liberal bias baked into artificial intelligence. Woke AI focuses on promoting new racial cultural stereotypes. And this, of course, has to do with the Gemini product, the Gemini branded AI. And there's one other item here that shows some law enforcement is involved. Of all things, the Attorney General of Montana, Austin Knudsen, he's demanding answers from Google regarding the woke AI system. And he is looking into the legal aspects of this. And he's saying that the Gemini system may violate Montana law by providing inaccurate information to users to fall in line with the tech giant's political preferences without disclosing that back to consumers. So there's a disclosure and fraud problem here. People are buying the product, and in his case in Montana, he's the attorney general, and they're not being told ahead of time that there's a baked-in bias. And I would add, ironically, that's the same thing with the mass media cartel, aka Legacy Media. We're told that that's a legitimate news, totally neutral, no agenda kind of news. But they also, the mainstream media, have a baked-in bias that they don't really disclose. There's no disclaimer. And yet we have to pay tax dollars on both sides of the pond for that news product. So in a similar way, people feel the Gemini thing is inherently biased, and they're purchasing it and they're not being told. But the bias is so ridiculous that when you ask AI to call up a picture of George Washington, he came out black, not white.
Okay, Mark, thank you. And of course, if this is happening in America, we can be sure it's happening here. But more troubles on the way with what I see as an attack on juries. Let's bring you back on, Alex. What have you got?
What's happened, Brian, is even Lord Sumption has lost his gumption. It's not the first time that the champion of our liberties within the retired judiciary during lockdown has shown that he's less libertarian and less pro-common law in other ways. If we go back a couple of years to January 2022, we see that in the wake of the Colston 4 verdict, which is where some het-up supposed anti-slavery campaigners created criminal damage and were let off by the jury. We might not like it, but it's the essence of jury nullification. In the wake of that, Lord Sumption already was telling LBC, a talk radio station in Britain, that he didn't particularly admire the jury system. His most cogent point was juries don't have to give their reasons. Now, in the US, where Mark's speaking from, jurors can be interviewed about why they acquitted or condemned. That's forbidden under English law. That is supposed to be a safeguard so that nobody can browbeat the jurors post hoc and say, what did you know? You're a bunch of idiots. This was a mistrial. But he's repeated his concerns now. He's writing as a reviewer this time of a piece on Channel 4 on British national television. This piece, at least in one of the sub-editing variants, has gone up under the comment headline in the Telegraph that the public are not aware of the high price we pay for juries. And he makes it clear at the end of this piece, he means financial and time price, and also, he suggests, a price of bad justice. Lord Sumption says, I won't read it all, that jurors are too ready to convict those accused of terrorism and accused of the sexual abuse of children. He adds the rider, probably. He says that in adult rape cases, they're probably ready, too ready to acquit the rapist. So he's going along, and I'll show you in the next extract as well, he's quoting Scotland in the middle there. He's going along with the Scottish government's nefarious plans, which we've covered, to direct judges by statute to direct in turn the juries. To convict rapists, those accused of rape in certain ways. Lord Sumption correctly reviews that in the early 19th century, Scotland and England decided to ditch civil juries for at least mandatory ones for civil trials. But he suggests that it's inexorable that in complex cases, and whenever it the judge deigns to say that this is too complex for the jurors' pretty little heads, a jury trial only can proceed. We'll go on later in the news to see an example of how that goes wrong in Northern Ireland, or at least the jurisdiction of Northern Ireland, having had the troubles during which, with the Diplock courts, there were no juries trials. But if anyone's concerned about where this begins and ends, it's not just the 2014 restriction of juries in libel trials, or before that, fraud trials in English law. It's not even the digital justice that Scotland and England brought in during COVID and haven't rolled back completely. It goes back fully 40 years. Here's the County Courts Act of 1984, and in one of its sections, section 66, people can freeze the screen to look at this, there were already plenty of provisions that, shall we say, minor proceedings, in that's not a technical legal term, but the less serious ones, shall be, if you look at subsection 2, without a jury, unless the court, that's the judge sitting alone, otherwise ordered. So if people aren't campaigning for the repeal of this Section 66 of the County Courts Act 1984, I don't regard them as champions of trial by jury anyway. If you're wondering what all the fuss is about, and we will be adding to this series soon, go to our podcast series. You can reach it from series on the homepage, A Dissident's Guide to the Constitution, where you will see that we go into democracy, which we led with Rishi Sunak's definition of it, and the necessity of jury law and indeed jury nullification.
Okay, Alex, thank you very much for that. Dangerous times. Mark, well, if we're losing juries here, or there's the effort to get rid of juries in UK, apologies, we've got the World Health Organization trying to take control of the nation states in other ways. What have you got?
Yes, the thing I did last week, the International Pathogen Surveillance Network launches catalytic grant fund, is just a one item in a long saga of things now. Now that UK Column's on the mailing list for the press releases and taking part occasionally in press conferences, there's just a plethora of information. As we know, the intergovernmental negotiating bodies working on the treaty, their last session ended March 1st. The next session goes March 18 through 28. So they're really scaling things up, shooting for that May 24 date to try and consummate the World Pandemic Treaty or instrument. But now they're really jacking up the One Health thing that I and others on UK Column have talked about from time to time. Leaders call for scale up and implementing One Health approach, and we'll move on from there. This is a major item that I read last night. And no amount of swinging the machete can get through the thicket of this thing. Talk about globalese, global language that has many, many meanings. And there are four UN agencies having to do with the WHO, agriculture, the environment, and one additional one that forms what they call the quadripartite. And then in this slide here, it talks about the guide for One Health, the guide to implementing One Health, what's called the Joint Plan of Action at the national level, provides practical guidance on how nations can adopt and adapt this Joint Plan of Action to strengthen and support the national One Health plan, the action plan, and building on the One Health Joint Plan of Action theory of change, which is very important. This guide describes three pathways and five key steps. There's three pathways listed here. Listeners and viewers can get into more details, but basically it's governance, organizational development, and data and information systems. Those are the three pathways. We'll move on from there. And this is sort of the Rosetta Stone of the whole thing, the underpinning of it, the One Health theory of change. It's the philosophy behind the policy, which then gives rise to the actions and then what they're trying to consummate. And this high-level body, the One Health high-level body, that's what that OHHLEP stands for. That's a rough translation of the acronym. The theory of change is prefaced on a recognition that the effects of human activity on our environment and planetary boundaries have a profound effect on the health and well-being of humans, animals, and the ecosystems we co-inhabit. That's a little bit of a snippet of the One Health theory of change. What's strange is as you read through all of this, they never quite get to fully explaining what that theory of change is. They sort of nibble around the edges. Again, as you try and get through this globalese, this heavy global language where words and concepts have multiple meanings, sometimes it's hard to even understand exactly what they're trying to say. Sometimes you read certain pages in this thing and you really don't know exactly what they're getting at. But One Health, just to recall in this slide, let's define that. We've talked about it before. It's an integrated, unifying approach that aims to sustainably balance and optimize the health of people, animals, and ecosystems. So the word balance, as Brian has brought out before, is very important because it doesn't really elevate people above animals and ecosystems. There's no more man being the crown of creation under a Christian worldview. This is a very collectivist, very humanistic worldview. It recognizes the health of humans, domestic and wild animals, plants, and the wider environment are closely linked and interdependent. Of course, there's some truth to that. You do need a healthy environment, but this goes further than that in terms of the relative value of human life and flora and fauna. And the approach mobilizes multiple sectors, disciplines, and communities at varying levels of society to work together to foster well-being and tackle threats to human, health and ecosystems, excuse me. So there's lots to unpack there, and there'll be plenty of links in the show notes for those that want to get into the heavy details. But here's what the WHO Director General is saying as all this is churning along, the catalytic fund, the negotiations for the treaty, and now the One Health thing being heavily integrated into all this. Tedros, the Director General of WHO, had this to say: we need sustained political will to ensure that these One Health principles are embedded in national and international policies. And he also added, implementation in countries, resource mobilization, science and evidence, and political will are all important. These are the four priorities that we must pursue together in the year ahead. So it shows, Brian, a very aggressive stance being taken by the WHO. They're unpacking and implementing everything they can. There's a lot of details. There's a lot of very nebulous language that can be interpreted many different ways, but it's a all points bulletin here, and it's all hands on deck for those concerned about human freedom, and to keep a close eye on the WHO and to get involved in any way they can at the local council level on up, to make sure that everyone understands the kind of power and the kind of influence that the WHO is pursuing here and what it may consummate in, because once that pandemic treaty is drawn up, there may be no turning back. So this is ultra important, and it's really heating up.
Excellent, Mark. Thank you very much for that. And Alex, we'll bring you back on, because if the World Health Organization is going for nation states across the world, we've also got powers under scrutiny in Northern Ireland.
Yes, we reported some time ago that during Brexit's negotiations in the hottest and most controversial period, the chef de cabinet, the political fixer, directly under Commissioner Juncker, who was then the president of the European Commission, a gentleman called Martin Selmayr, widely rumoured to be ex-German intelligence, said, if Britain wishes to leave the European Union, its price will be Northern Ireland. We see that the European Union does regard itself as owning Northern Ireland. Now, it's par for the course that in treaties, such as the treaty that got Britain out of the EU, the executives in question, the European Commission and His Majesty's government, they would regard that as sacrosanct. But as we've often said, treaties do not automatically bind because they don't involve the judiciaries and the parliaments, the other two branches of government in countries. But we see the extent of capture, certainly of the judiciary in Northern Ireland, because a matter has now come up to the High Court in Northern Ireland under Justice Colton regarding this piece of legislation, which is a Westminster Act. Stormont wasn't sitting last year, and certainly didn't pass, can't pass anything like this. It hasn't got competences. But this is perhaps the most significant thing that has come out of Westminster in the quarter century since the Belfast Agreement or Good Friday Agreement of 1998. It's the Northern Ireland Troubles Brackets Legacy and Reconciliation Act of last year. It's pretty slapdash to call the Troubles in statute. It's a very colloquial term. But this is the moment at which Westminster, having washed its hands of Northern Ireland many years ago, one thinks of Sir Paddy Mayhew in the Major administration in the 90s saying we have no interest in Northern Ireland. This is the point at which His Majesty's government goes proceeds to say, right, well, we can't be bothered prosecuting terrorists anymore, no matter how many murders they've committed and tortures they've done. No, we're going to the economic recovery job now. Now, Joshua Rosenberg, many people will recall him as the BBC's legal correspondent years ago. Not always to my liking, but I have to admit his thoroughness and perspicacity in some areas. He has blogged last week in Substack under A Lawyer Writes this: hold below the waterline, byline, judge disapplies Northern Ireland Troubles legislation, the Westminster Act I just showed you. Now, Westminster will always call from the rafters that it is parliamentary sovereign. We've often attacked that principle in the Dissident's Guide to the Constitution. But here we see that they get their comeuppance because a judge in Northern Ireland has disapplied an act of parliament. Now, it's pretty complicated, and the links don't no longer work from that piece that you can see to the judiciary piece. So we'll go with Joshua Rosenberg's breakdown of what's happened. Brexit included what's now known as the Windsor Accord. It was the withdrawal agreement at first, which is an undertaking not between us and the Irish government, but between His Majesty's government and the European Commission directly, that certain EU legal standards will continue to apply. This is about parity of rights. This doesn't just apply with the continent or even just with the Irish Republic. It has domestic effect in Northern Ireland now. In particular, judicial review was taken. That's relatives challenging whether or not it was fit for Westminster to write off future punishment for torturers and murderers. And the judicial review was taken on the standard grounds of incompatibility with human rights. We've had that in UK law since 1998. But specifically and additionally, for Northern Ireland only, there is a secondary route, which is this infringes my right under the EU withdrawal agreement, part of which was that EU law for this purpose and EU equality will continue to apply in Northern Ireland. Justice Colton looked at that in some detail. And as Rosenberg rightly summarizes, he concludes that all six of the tests were met. Therefore, he struck out the provisions of this supposedly sovereign act of the Mother of Parliaments. He did so even though this act post-dated the withdrawal agreement and the transposition of that through the Westminster Parliament. So it even calls into question this idea of implied repeal, which itself was a fudge that came out of the Metric Martyrs case. You can see that when one lie and fudge is invented, more lies and fudge have to come along to cover them up. Well, now this idea of implicit repeal, which is how the government got out of a tight spot over the Metric Martyrs case, it didn't want to admit that EU regulations and directives were supreme over UK law in Parliament. That has now caused more egg on the face because a judge can do this. And if the UK had remained in the EU, he said, this law would never have been passed. Therefore, there was no competence for Parliament to pass it anyway. There is no parliamentary sovereignty. Tony Blair and the IRA is the book to read. I've given you the Goodreads book, and it'll be in the show notes there. If you want to know where this began, it began with a personal pledge by Tony Blair, anxious for his place in history and perhaps buttering up the Vatican before his conversion. He went on to issue these comfort letters through his staff to many IRA murderers. And we've reached the pitch now that it's not His Majesty's government that cannot countenance the idea of these murderers and torturers being let off. No, it's the European Union acting through its subsidiaries in Northern Ireland, in the judiciary as well as the executive, who are saying, oh no, Westminster can't do that. And I'm afraid in this case, they're right. They have less awful and abysmal legal and moral standards than His Majesty's government, which was planning just to let all of these prisoners off and accused people off scot-free.
Alex, thank you very much for that detailed analysis. More problems for UK as a whole there in Northern Ireland. Well, if people like what UK Column is doing, then please support us and become a subscriber. We can only do what we do with your financial support, and subscriptions and donations are what keep UK Column going. So if you're not already a subscriber, please consider doing that and help support us financially. You can also help us, of course, by making a purchase through the shop. And we've been having a little special promotion of matters to do with COVID. So we've t-shirts variants of concern are still available. And of course, we've got the famous Tube Rain t-shirt as well. Please share what we are sharing with you, because the aim is to get the material out as far and wide as it can. But of course, please do credit UK Column if you do that. Now, we'd also like to say that tomorrow at 1 o'clock, the first of the new edition of No Smoke Without Fire will be going out. That's myself and Debbie Evans. We've got a series of No Smokes coming out on what we're calling the Green King. We're having an in-depth look at King Charles and what he's actually been up to in the background and how he sees the world. Some of this is quite astonishing, if not frightening. So join us at 1 o'clock tomorrow to learn more about that. Now, we'd also like to say the farmers are clearly gearing up. So we've got Your Farmers Need You. Join a farmer for a open forum public meeting. That's Wednesday, the 6th of March at 7 p.m. And there is the address below the pffa.org webinar address in order to find out more about that. We've also got a solidarity rally, March the 16th, 12:30 Truro. That's a drive between Arch Hill and Trafalgar Roundabout. And you can get details of that by scanning the code. And I'm assured that when that code's up on the UK Column site, that will work for you. We'd also like to help promote a really interesting evening. Ladies first. So Sandy Adams will there talking about social justice and also the human and spiritual battle going on. Clive de Carle will also be there, of course, better known for his health knowledge. And Richard Vobes, who's doing some really great work now on many subjects. So that's Saturday, the 3rd of March, 7 till 10 p.m. Doors opening at 6:30, and it's the Avalon Club, 50 High Street, Glastonbury. So that's £15 is a basic ticket, but there are £10 concession tickets. So do investigate that. And this one, I think, Alex, is yours. Repeal the Climate Change Act, 2008 and net zero targets. Is that right?
Yes, it is, Brian. Just to say that I'm very glad to mention this in passing. It's been sent to us with a request to mention. We've just seen that, for all its faults, Parliament is the way, is the means we have to stand up to any supranational bullying. Parliament still has the ability, in that Northern Ireland case, to tell the judges where to get off, as it always does when they give human rights castigations of the government. And in this case, there's nothing to beat pressure on our own parliamentary representatives to repeal their own acts, because supranational bodies acting through parliaments can only really be got out by the right acts within Parliament. So that petition will be in the show notes. Which takes me to Germany, where egg on face has reached new heights. Zero Hedge has reported this, and I'm sorry that the headline is obscure. That's my fault with the slide. But the there has been an intercept published by the Russians, and they've admitted it was their own intercept as well as their own publication transcript of it, of high-level German defense officials from the Bundeswehr discussing how to get Taurus missiles to Ukraine. And they're actually talking in it about the possibility that the Ukrainians will use these missiles to attack the Kerch Strait Bridge, as you'll see on screen there at the moment. Now, the incriminating thing here is that during the call, the German defense officials admit that there is not any legitimacy or urgency of making the Kerch Strait Bridge of Russia between what's now Russian Crimea and Russian North Caucasus. There's no necessity for Ukraine to target that. And they admit in the call it is a political long-term goal of the Ukrainians to bring it down, which is why they have started wanting Taurus missiles. If we go to the transcript here, which has only been published by Sputnik International. I would supply a Western source if anyone had bothered, but nobody else has transcribed it, even in the native German, let alone in English, that I can see. I'll go through some of the detail in this in a moment, but first we're just going to listen to a few seconds of the intercept. Native speakers of German will recognize the words Lücke and Brücke, so a hole in the bridge is what they're talking about. And the gentleman you're about to see in the inset top left of the slide graphic in a moment is not a minor figure. He is actually Generalleutnant Gerhards, who is the Air Chief Marshal. He is the commander, or as they say in Germany, the inspector of the Luftwaffe. And he's on the phone to his J3, his head of operations, who's in Singapore, probably how the Russians were able to intercept this piece, and also to two underlings who seem to be his missile boffins from the Space Command. Listen to a few seconds of the intercept.
Ich kann noch mal schnell ergänzen wegen der Brücke, weil wir die uns intensiv angeguckt haben. Und die Brücke ist leider aufgrund ihrer Größe wie ein Flugplatz. Das heißt, es kann durchaus sein, dass ich dafür 10 oder 20 Flugkörper brauche.
Ich habe 12 geschätzt, wenn er da, wo er aufklappt, wenn er die Pfeiler nimmt.
Ja, und selbst der Pfeiler, da machen wir unter Umständen nur ein Loch rein und dann stehen wir da.
Ja. Quite calmly there, the commander of the Luftwaffe is hearing from his underlings, it would probably take 10 or 20 of our Taurus missiles, sir, for the Ukrainians to blow up this Russian bridge. And in the call, do read the transcript that I've just shown and which I'll link to. There is plenty of detail about how it would be better for Germany to be sly and use a ruse like the French, rather than just be in your face like the British, because the British and French supply Storm Shadow and related types of missile not too dissimilar from Taurus. And the head of the Luftwaffe and his underlings there are saying, we don't want to be like the Brits and just send a troop carrier, a Ridgeback, with these components. And they also chuckle in an aside that we all know about the gentleman in civilian attire and American accents washing around Ukraine, ho-ho. No, we're going to be like the French. We're going to do it through MBDA, the supposedly international conglomerate, supposedly independent of the ministries of defense of the European countries. We're going to supply German military staff through MBDA so that we have plausible deniability, and we're going to keep testing where the German chancellor or prime minister's red lines are. We don't want to be more gutsy than the British in this. The training we can just give to the British, because there's a big political item in Germany at the moment about a couple of weeks of German training, then hand it over to the British. The Chancellor has really irritated the spokeswoman or the chairwoman of the Defence Committee in Parliament, sorry, the Foreign Affairs Committee in Parliament, Alicia Kearns, because Scholz's spokesman let slip that the British already have people on the ground doing this, no surprise to us. And he got really castigated for this in strong terms. So he's clearly the junior partner here. But all the way through this call, which you can read, it's 40 minutes long and the transcript's there in English on Sputnik. They're saying, well, the British are already doing this. The French are doing it more slyly. This is going to be a long-term project. It's a political goal. What are the repercussions in Russia? Konstantin Kosachev, the chairman of the or speaker of the upper house of the Russian parliament, has been saying this calls into question whether Germany is a belligerent party in this war or not. Dmitry Medvedev, who is often off the wall, the most extreme Russian prominent man, the former president and prime minister still in the National Security Council, is saying the Krauts are up to their old tricks. They're back to reverting to their type as the archetypal villains. Bash the Krauts, death to the German fascists. Really lurid stuff, but you can imagine, understand why. And while all this is happening, the German newspaper of record, FAZ, the Frankfurter Allgemeine, is reporting that the health minister, no less, in Germany, is about to present a bill to the German parliament, and he's saying that we need the health ministry to be ready for a war. He says it would be naive to imagine that we're not going to have a war.
Pretty incredible stuff. But of course, the whole thing is proving that this indeed is a proxy war. And there's no question that French, British and American special forces have been on the ground for a very long time, helping facilitate the Ukrainian attacks. So this is just consolidating information, but taking a dangerous step forward with the intent to destroy that bridge. Now, where does that take us? I think it's back to you, Mark. And, what have you got here?
Thanks, Brian. On a fairly regular basis, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, the former Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, does their Lester Crown Center on U.S. Foreign Policy Survey. It used to go under another name until 2018. I've been covering it intermittently over the last several years. Well, this is the latest Lester Crown Center on U.S. Foreign Policy Survey, and it says, in collaboration with the marketing firm and research firm Ipsos, and the Chicago Global Affairs Council itself, Americans continue to support military and economic aid to Ukraine. But there's a lot of nuance in this, as we'll see. Let's move forward. Support for sending military aid to Ukraine is strongest among Democrats, that's significant, and independents at 75 and 54% respectively. By contrast, these increasingly populist anti-war Republicans, I'm elaborating a little bit, 53% of them in the survey were opposed. Overall public support for the war, however, the council is admitting, has steadily declined. Near the start of the war in March of 2022, 79% of Americans surveyed supported sending military aid to Ukraine. In September of 2023, that support dropped all the way to 63%. Today, it's at 58%, so a pretty precipitous drop. Nearly 70% of Americans are in favor of the U.S. supporting Ukraine's admission to NATO, however. The survey was conducted notably February 16 through February 18 of 1,039 American adults. Just a little basic facts there. We'll move on from there. The key findings, these, of course, will be available in the show notes. It's about a 10-page result of the survey. 6 in 10 Americans favor providing both economic assistance to Ukraine and sending additional arms and military supplies. That's 58%. Majorities of Democrats and independents favor providing military aid to Ukraine, which a majority of Republicans, 53%, oppose. We've touched on that. Similarly, majorities of Democrats and independents support providing economic assistance to Ukraine, while Republicans are opposed. 7 in 10 Americans, 69%, including majorities across party lines, favor the U.S. supporting Ukraine's admission to NATO. and a majority, 60%, say that the U.S. security relationship with Ukraine does more to strengthen U.S. national security than it does to weaken it. I'll note that on that last item, there's nothing provided in the overall survey and the results that explains how this actually benefits the U.S. and its taxpayers. What I will note that Lester Crown, the namesake of the foreign policy outfit within the Chicago Council, on whose name this survey was conducted, Lester Crown is the 98-year-old son of Henry Crown. Henry Crown, Brian, was the founder of the major defense contractor to this day, General Dynamics. So conceivably, the way that the U.S. benefits with the economic aid and other aid to Ukraine in terms of any benefit would be profits for defense contractors. Anyway, we have one of many slides that were in the survey results. We'll just show this one, support for economic aid to Ukraine. Yes, there are majorities that support this economic aid. However, since March of 2022 until February of this year, you can see that for Democrats, Republicans, independents, and overall, that support has declined. It's kind of edged its way down. And the same thing is true for military aid to Ukraine and so on and so forth. And the most precipitous drop, the biggest drop, is any idea, Brian, of using American troops in Ukraine. There's a major disagreement there. The people surveyed don't want any part of that. The support for such an idea is very low. But the contradiction that I caught, Brian, and to its credit, the Chicago Council also caught this contradiction, was that while there's lots of support for Ukraine entering NATO, if they did, the NATO setup, of course, is an attack on one alliance member, is an attack on all. So it would actually guarantee more military activity and potentially World War III if NATO made Ukraine a full official member. Then the U.S. would be obliged to send troops in. So there's the contradiction. Those surveyed don't want any part of sending American troops into Ukraine, yet they want Ukraine to join NATO. And if it did, an attack on Ukraine would oblige those very same U.S. troops to go help Ukraine. So even the Chicago Council can't quite fully figure out why there's that inherent inconsistency and contradiction. But overall, Brian, the main lesson, the main takeaway from this is that while slim majorities of Americans support the economic aid, the military aid, and those sorts of things, that majority keeps shrinking. And the Democrats, long thought to be the party of peace, the anti-war party traditionally over many decades, just like Democrats were thought to be the pro-labor, the pro-working man party, in both areas, the Democratic Party is proving itself to be a real loser. They're no longer the party of the working man, certainly not like they were, and they're no longer the anti-war party. But the Republicans have that mantle, ironically, when for years Republicans were called warmongers. So there's lots of paradigm shifts and seismic shifts going on. But the bottom line, again, is that the majorities that support these things in America keep slipping down and going down and down and down. And pretty soon it could very well go the other way. So the Chicago Council is obviously fishing, Brian, hoping that they can somehow maintain a patina of public support for what's going on in Ukraine and the American aid into that. So it shows just how weak that support ultimately is from Americans.
Shows how weak. It also, I think, shows how desperate they are in order to get their case across that all is well. Certainly, Colonel Douglas McGregor over the weekend was saying that, in his opinion, support was dropping away. Support for Ukraine was dropping away very quickly in the United States. Well, Alex, let's bring you in. Kriegsmarine has got a few problems.
From the Luftwaffe to the Kriegsmarine, Brian. With the Luftwaffe, the problem was they were knowingly setting up a long-term project to help the Ukrainians shoot down a bridge with up to 20 missiles, as they themselves estimate, where they themselves acknowledge in the same call it's not necessary because the Russians have a thick land bridge on the Black Sea littoral now to supply Crimea and southern Ukraine. At the same time, the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, has a problem. They've sent out the Hessen, a rather clapped-out frigate, And the Frankfurter Allgemeine is reporting here that the Hessen has inadvertently shot at an Allied drone in the Red Sea, part of the anti-Houthi operations going on here. But there are other things going on in that theatre of operation as well. The problem here, as we'll see in the admission on screen now from the German Defence Ministry, is that, it's Der Spiegel that found it first, FAZ has syndicated it, that the Defence Ministry has said that this was not an enemy drone, but we only found out afterwards that it was there. They stressed that the Germans had already asked all their NATO allies, have you got any drones in this sector where we're sending the Hessen to shoot down drones? And they weren't told about this drone, probably because it was on a separate, perhaps a unilateral or bilateral counter-terrorism mission. So it wasn't identified. Some observers have even suggested that the drone's IFF, its identification, was turned off, which some people think is an international legal crime, but countries will justify it under CT operations. The worst bit, though, on screen is that it's because of a technical defect to the missiles fired from the clapped-out old frigate, the Hessen. Both of the interceptor missiles shot at it just went plop back into the Red Sea and didn't hit the presumed US drone. What we know for sure is it's a Reaper. It may not have been operated by the US. It may have been a European country operating it. Now, the opposition has made hay with this, and that's on screen at the moment, but I've translated it for you. Here it is. Florian Hahn, an MP from Bavaria, from the pseudo or quasi-conservative opposition, has had this to say. He said, with regard to pressing the government, that when we pressed the Bundeswehr, the Ministry of Defence, we found out that some of the Hessen's weapons systems seem not to be available to reorder as the industrial capacity isn't there anymore. He goes on, so that when these components have been fired off, and we've just seen that two of them failed anyway, the German Navy won't be able to replenish them, so the frigate is going to have to withdraw from theatre. He concludes, thus, Parliament, the Bundestag, voted on a deployment in ignorance of an apparent problem with the Type 124 frigates. I don't know whether it can get any more serious than that. At this stage, the Germans seem not to have a navy, and they only discover it in anger during wartime operations.
Well, my comment on that is at least Parliament voted on it. From what I see in UK, we have more and more forces deployed overseas with no parliamentary vote. Did you have one last
yes.
image?
Just
there?
Very briefly to point out that Die Welt, a more conservative paper, has got a list, although it is behind a paywall, of everything missing and broken and superannuated on this Type 124 frigate, the Hessen. Some reports claim that the radar was the targeting radar. This would be was due to be replaced before she sailed off to the Red Sea, but wasn't. That might be a big red clue as to why the firing at the drone failed.
Okay, thank you for that, Alex. Well, just very quickly here, this is something caught my eye this morning. But what does it signify? I think it signifies this childish view of the world that's creeping into so many places. So BBC with a headline, "Working for MI6, more exciting than a James Bond film, says spy." And if we just have a couple of the quotes, "Working for MI6 can be more exciting than a James Bond film, a director for the agency has told the BBC." Well, this is apparently the finance and human resources director. He goes on to say, "I've also seen some of the coolest stuff, things that'll blow your mind. You have to be in it to see it." This is the language of a youngster, a young teenager, but we're now to trust somebody working in MI6. And then, of course, the real agenda going on is a big drive to bring in a different class of people. So he says, "I'm afraid it makes you think that everyone who works here is a white middle-class male who's driving an Aston Martin, who likes women and all that. But that's not true." We're very tight for time in this news. So Alex, we'll bring it into extra time for a bit of discussion. But I just see a puerile attitude now being brought into MI6. And I'm sure this is dangerous. Mark, we're going to bring you back in here because I mentioned Colonel McGregor. Over the weekend, talking about the support for Ukraine falling. But the other thing that he said is people in the States are much more concerned about the southern border issue. And I think you'd agree with that.
Yes, they don't want to aid Ukraine at the expense of the border. In other words, all those multi-billion dollars a record number of dollars, according to Rand Paul, as I reported last week. With all that money going to Ukraine, people are saying, what about the southern border? Well, this past Thursday, I had Joe Biden visiting Brownsville to the east of me, and Donald Trump over in Eagle Pass to the west of me. The weather was too a little bit inclement and the security too tight to go see Biden. That'd be a real snoozer anyway. But anyway, we have a video of a little bit of what Donald Trump had to say at Eagle Pass this past Thursday, and Governor Greg Abbott of Texas was there. So I think we can give that a listen.
3 years ago, we had the most secure border in history. Brandon was saying it. The general was saying it. We had the most secure border, and people weren't coming because they knew they weren't going to get in. And we weren't promising free education, free medical, free everything. I mean, all the promises that are made, no wonder they come. I mean, you look at what this governor, Newsom from California, isn't that his name, Newsom? What he's done to California is unbelievable. People are pouring in. They think they're going to get medical aid. And our soldiers, our vets aren't being taken care of. But people that come into our country illegally are. We ended catch and release. We built 571 miles of border wall, much more than I promised I'd build. And in addition, we purchased another 200 miles, and they sold that, much of it, for 5 cents on the dollar.
And it just so happens, Brian, that I found recently where some of that sold off fence, sold for pennies on the dollar, is stacked. And that's only about 6 or 7 miles from where I'm sitting. Back at the time, mainstream press had a story about it. $100 million in border wall materials rusting away in Texas, according to a report. And this report from the New York Post, notably, said that a lot of that fencing was in FAR, Texas, spelled P-H-A-R-R. Technically, it's in Alamo, right next to FAR. And I found that recently and made a video of my own of what I call Biden's graveyard, his border fence graveyard. And so we'll see a short clip of what I filmed there.
This is the 23rd of February, 2024, UK Column News correspondent Mark Anderson in Alamo, Texas, along Business 83, just shy of Tower Road. These are multiple fence sections for the southern border fence here in Hidalgo County that were never put up. They were ordered under the Trump administration, as I understand it, but canceled by Biden once he became president, and he forbade them to be put up and then sold it off for pennies on the dollar, according to my best sources. It's a vast field of border fence sections. Getting around the trash bin here, and we'll see it close up what they look like. Mark Anderson, UK Column, signing off.
So there you go, a little bit of field work to show what that unerected border fence looks like. And as Trump noted, it would have covered something like a couple hundred miles. And this isn't the only stack of unused fence. There's some elsewhere, but this is the vast majority of it that he actually referred to last Thursday.
Okay, Mark, thank you for that. Well, if you don't want to put the fence up, your policy must be to allow people to come into the states in huge numbers. And question is why? Well, I think we know why, to help break apart American society. I've got an eye on the clock, Alex, so I'd say, would you like to give an introduction to matters around Hull? And we'll save the meat of the material for UK Column Extra after the news.
Well, let's keep the slides till extra then, and I'll just say that we have had a very informative email in from Hull, an unglamorous but important British city. The council seems to be presented with a fait accompli from central government now, which is, in order to get a paltry sum, which is being presented as a great amount of money but isn't, I think, £13 million, you must merge with the nearby and completely different rural area. So the city of Hull is left-leaning and urban, and you've got this conservative rural area behind it, now called the East Riding, effectively a county. formerly part of Yorkshire, they're being told you must merge. And there's some very pressing questions. So I think that our more clued up viewers and committed ones who are in extra time will be able to help this viewer. But if you are going to miss that, then consider it as a reason to sign up, because you know we have a community of people who are helping each other in ways like this, in how to tackle local government abuses, which turn out to have supranational roots.
Okay, Alex, thank you very much for that. I was smiling, but it was a wry smile at what was going on. If we summarise our news today, we've got the assault on people worldwide. It often doesn't matter what country they live in, whether they're in UK or they're in Germany or another country in the European Union, or of course they're over the pond and they're in the United States. We are seeing breakdown accompanied with an ever more onerous system of government, and this cannot be accidental. This must be global policy that we're watching. How fascinating. We're now suddenly coming back on something very local in Hull, which gives us another piece of evidence that this policy is real and seeks to do us harm. I'm just going to ask you, as we end today, I put up the clip saying to people, if you want to understand things that seem difficult to understand, consider that you're being attacked. Am I being too harsh by suggesting this to people?
I don't think William of Ockham, the medieval scholar, would have said so, because he coined the razor, didn't he? The explanation that does least violence to common sense is probably the right one. And this is the one penny that, once it drops, seems to explain most of what our governments are doing to us.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll leave it there. We're going to say a big thank you to everybody that's joined us today, wherever you are in the world. And once again, if you like what we're doing, please consider taking out a subscription with us, because we can only do what we do with your financial support. We'll leave it there. Extra time will be there for our members in a few minutes. And we will be back for another UK Column News on Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Thank you. Bye-bye.